Blog Talk Radio. This is Love's Outer Limits, and I'm your host, Dr. Amy Marsh, sexologist, hypnotist, lots of other kinds of things, and I'm with my co-host, M. Christian, otherwise known as Chris, erotica writer, sexuality writer, sexual futurist, and also lots of all kinds of other things. We've got a great show lined up for you today, so welcome.
Hey, good morning, Chris, and good morning, listeners. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I am absolutely ragged. I had the worst night of sleep in a long time, and one of my cats has been throwing up all morning. And
poor sweetie.
Yeah. So it's been a strange morning, and yet I was also having a wonderful conversation at 8 a.m. with my ex-student from Brazil. So, you know, it's been a real mix already, and it's only 11. How about you?
Well, it's funny. I had another bad night's sleep as well, so maybe it's something in the atmosphere or something. So I'm okay. I've had my coffee, and I'm caffeinated. I'm, you know, all set to go. But, yeah, my brain is a little fried.
Okay, well, that makes two of us, so but we're going to carry on just as we usually do. So we're going to shout out a few things make space, I think, for a little bit of news, our items about stuff with, you know, things that are going on with the protest. Mm-hmm. And gosh, I hope everybody just forgives me. I'm just not as together or articulate as I'd hope to be at this show, but
perfectly okay.
Thank you. Yes. And likewise, we'll be gentle with each other here. The one of the things I've been tracking is the professional organizations in the sexology world that have been making statements about the protests, Black Lives Matter, and, you know, happy to say that ASECT, the American Association of Sexualities, Educators and Counselors, has made a statement. The National Coalition on Sexual Freedom has issued a statement. I looked at the National Guild of Hypnotists, which is another professional organization I belong to, but so far I haven't seen a thing from them. But they don't have a, I don't know. I sometimes don't understand that organization. It's very staid. So perhaps that's why I don't understand it. But I'm just kind of tracking responses. How about you, Chris? Have you noticed anything come on your radar? People have made statements, vowed to do better about systemic racism and so on.
Not particularly, though I do have to say that I'm quite excited to see that the groundswell hasn't been dying down. If anything, it's kind of gaining more and more momentum, which is wonderful. I do like to see, again, as we discussed last show, that, you know, some corporations are actually, you know, putting their money where their mouth is. Of course, it's a small amount, but it's still nice to see them recognizing it, and that's quite good. And I do have to say that I'm 100% supporting of what's happening in Seattle. I think this is a beautiful experience, and I think that I really applaud the people who are putting it together. I did hear, I think, today that they're negotiating right now with the police to, you know, turn back that area of the city, you know, to them. But, again, it's an example of what could be and what should be happening all around the country.
So for our listeners, can you go into a little more detail in case people haven't caught this particular news item? Yeah.
I do have to say that my information is a little scattered, just like I am today. But as far as I know, activists basically took control over an area. I think it's around the city hall, and I believe it's like a 6-block radius, and basically set up what's called a temporary autonomous zone, which is a self-governed area where, you know, that they basically kind of like do their own policing. And from every recount I've heard, it's been peaceful and if not beautiful, with like, you know, screenings of the 13 movie, you know, free food being offered, supplies for the coronavirus outbreak, all this kind of stuff. And it's really kind of a good example of how a community can, you know, create, you know, a safe space for everyone and without the need for police, you know, brutality. So I'm actually quite pleased with this.
That's fantastic. And I want to note that the encampment of protectors of Mauna Kea has been going on since July 15th, last year, 2019. And this is also a community that I think you could apply the autonomous zone moniker to them as well, though what they call themselves is a place of refuge. And they're a place of refuge, a pu'uhonua, at a location called Pu'uhuluhulu. And this is at the base of Mauna Kea, and they're there to protect the sacred mountain from further telescope desecration. And they have had in place since July 15th last year, food, medical care, carting garbage in and out, water in and out, daily rituals, I think in the morning and the evening, for honoring Mauna Kea. They've accommodated visitors. Of course, the population has fluctuated, you know, depending on, you know, the season of the year, but there's been a very consistent presence. And again, very self-governing. The times that the police have gone in, unfortunately, there have been times where there have been arrests, there's been unseemly behavior, but for the most part, that's what comes in from the outside. As far as the community itself goes, it's been very, very wonderful. So let's just give a shout out to the Native Hawaiians for having had something in place for over a year, almost a year now. And then also to applaud Seattle and other places that are doing the same thing. I also want to mention that Tickle.life, and we always like to give a shout out to them, quickly put up anti-racism resource kits, three of them. So we have links to that in our show notes, and that's right along with the Tickle.life coronavirus COVID-19 resources as well. So I think we're both happy to be engaged with a very public-spirited and aware organization here. And yeah, there's a lot to say. Anyway, I've kind of used up a lot of air for the moment. What other shout-outs do you have, Chris?
Just really quickly, kind of the usual suspects for me, that the queer majority is a wonderful resource, and that there's some really wonderful posts about, you know, queer identity and among people of color and being allies and such. Futureofsex.net, of course, is one of my all-time favorite places to write for. The great folks at Kinkley have also been very active around, you know, standing behind what's happening in this country. You know, and I also want to give a little brief mention that tomorrow I do the first of my 2-part erotica writing class for the folks at As You Like It, a female-run and operated, you know, sexuality emporium, I guess you could call it, you know, here in Eugene. So I believe the tickets are still available for the first one. The second one will be on the 14th. The first one focuses on beginners, you know, how to find, write erotic stories. And the second part is on the business end of things, which is the scary part.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. And I hope that this is just the start of many more. Getting into online education, I think is, well, obviously it's what we can do now. So great. I hope it's a success and that you have fun doing it. let's see. I think we've got a topic today that I think is really a topic you're going to shine in, because this is much more, you know, so much more about the world of science fiction and speculative fiction than I do. I enjoy reading things, but I'm really kind of haphazard with what I come across. But to also mention that on our Loves Outer Limits Facebook page, We do have links to lists that Chris, you and I have put together on Black writers of science fiction and fantasy and their books, and a list of LGBTQIA plus authors and books, also of fantasy, science fiction, speculative fiction. So the lists, there's so much content, we can't put that in the show notes here on Blog Talk Radio. So we've decided to start utilizing our show Facebook page for that. So hope you go there and discover lots and lots and lots of good reading. And we'll be talking more about that. Other than that, I think my only shout out is there was a great post by Maxi Glamour, who's one of the Dragula contestants, I believe from season 2, wrote an excellent blog about intersectional activism. Really, really loved it. I'll try and find that and put that link also into our show notes so that people can go to that and read. It was a really good piece. I was happy to see that. So I think that's all I've got to say for the moment. How do we want to launch this topic?
I'm not too sure how to start. I do know that, thank you very much for the sweet, mentioning that I've been into this, because science fiction has always been something I've always been a really huge fan of. I don't consider myself an expert by a long shot, but I have read more than my fair share, and there's very few writers I haven't actually read. Not so much fantasy. I've always kind of leaned more towards speculative fiction, but, it's something that for me was always kind of like, one, it was interesting, and two, that it was also sort of gave me hope for the future. I mean, even dystopic books, there was still a future.
Really good point, yeah. I think that's what some of my favorite science fiction books always do include, this idea of a future, and also this idea of there's a different way of doing things. There's always mm-hmm. been, for me, this element of imagining the new and better worlds or the new and better ways of life that has always drawn me to different books. Yeah. And as you say, even when they're dystopian, there's usually some interesting ideas in there. And just the fact that people can imagine, the year 2050 is kind of a plus right now, right? Yeah. So, how are we going to start this? I guess I could mention, too, that you and I are both fiction writers, as well as mm-hmm. the other things that we do. So, Chris, do you want to talk about some of your own sexy science fiction that you've written?
Sure. I mean, it's funny because I don't want to get too much into it because it's a fairly long story. But, when I first started to, when I first actually started to publish, it was in Ironica because that was a market where people were buying. And, being a long time, once again, geek, nerd, fan, you want to call it, when I had the opportunities to write erotic science fiction, I mean, for me, it was just writing science fiction, so I kind of leapt at it. So I've been very honored that I've had several places that published it, and I can't remember when exactly it was. I mean, my first actual published story was erotic science fiction. That was for Future Sex magazine. But I've written, probably like several dozen science fiction erotic horror stories, a couple of novels. So for me, it was always kind of a really interesting way of exploring sex in the future. And I'm still doing it. I just finished 3 stories that are erotic science fiction that hopefully will see the light of day fairly soon. So for me, it's always been very exciting. And I have to say, I'm really honored that, many of my stories have been released in various collections. Most recently, sort of my best of erotic science fiction, called A Hard Drive. But yeah, it's always kind of been near to my heart because, again, it's a sense of optimism that, especially when you can take, interesting, technologies and sort of extrapolate and have fun with how that could affect sex in the future, which is, like I said, absolutely delightful.
Right, right. And of course, we've always shown the cover of your book, Hard Drive, in the little slideshow that accompanies these shows, ever since you came on board. And where can people find that?
It's available on pretty much everywhere. It's available as an ebook. And on Kindle and such. It's also available as a paperback on print on demand on Amazon. And there's even an audiobook version through the wonderful folks at Word Loose Publishing, so you can listen to it. That's available on Audible. And speaking of books, and you're working on a whole series, which I think is absolutely wonderful. And I hope you're going to share a little bit about that.
Yeah, I will. I guess this is the time and the place for it. I've been working on a fantasy series based on the Guild of Ornamental Hermits. And it's kind of some of my inspiration is the urban fantasy work of people like Emma Bull, the idea of the worlds of elves or fairies colliding with the human world and impact on, you know, society and culture and just everyday life. You know, I've always thought that was really fun. I liked books, War for the Oaks, of course, is her first one and probably best known. And the young adult book, Finder, I've also really enjoyed. When I really like a book, I'll reread it several times. And I have to say, I've reread both of those books of Emma Bull's a lot. And they were also books that we shared in our family with my children when they were growing up. They're just cool. And so I've also been really intrigued for quite a long time by ornamental hermits, which were people hired in England mostly during the, probably mid-18th century to sort of dress up like Gandalf before there was a Gandalf and live in these little, you know, mossy grottos, you know, with a big moldy Bible or some other sort of obscure book and, you know, with hair and beard growing out. I guess these were mostly men. And this was something the wealthy families did to bring elements that were more picturesque and also a reminder of mortality into their lavish English country house life. It's something that I think is intriguing. I think it should be a 21st century career opportunity. Hint, hint, those of you in the 1% start hiring those ornamental hermits now, giving them a place to live and a stipend and, you know, like that. But my Guild of Ornamental Hermits is a modern day mystery school. There's the first book takes place on Hawaii Island, the island also known as the Big Island, you know, where we've got the volcano, the wonderful volcano, lots of other things. And the second book in the series takes place here in Lake County, California. And the third book in the series, I'm imagining this as a trilogy, will take place partially in England. So the first book is called The Dire Deeds of the Guild of Ornamental Hermits. The second book is called The Witching Work of the Guild of Ornamental Hermits. And the third book will be called The Perilous Past of the Guild of Ornamental Hermits. So obviously I kind of like alliteration, right? And I call these tales of midlife magic because the characters in the book, aside from being very, very diverse collection in gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, also quite a lot of them are older. So this is people who discover late in life that they actually have this relationship to a strange, obscure mystery school and school of magic and magical practices and a heritage that they weren't aware of. So, yeah, how do they contend with that, you know, while going through menopause or, you know, or in the case of the first book, it centers around the human beings are all part of the Hermitville Farm and Arts Collective set in Pahoa, Hawaii, or the Puna District of Hawaii Island. And so, you know, they're a great bunch of weirdos, basically art people, music people, misfits, you know, finding a home and growing, you know, mangoes and lots of other crops and, you know, raising chickens and making music and getting into all kinds of trouble. So I'm not sure how much I should say, though. I don't want to use up too much time.
Well, it sounds wonderful.
Thank you. I'm having fun. I haven't been able to do much work on these books the last, I'd say the last month and a half or so. Somehow my concentration just hasn't been there, but I'm really itching to get back into it because I'm in the process of doing the final revision on the first book and a second draft revision on the second book. So I've actually written all the way through. The first book was over 250,000 words. And the first draft, I realized I had to cut that back dramatically or nobody would ever want to publish it. And so I've really pared down and tried to make it as streamlined as possible while still retaining, you know, all the things that are in there that I want to have in the book. So, yeah. I know that we're thinking about reading parts of our book, but do we want to save that for later on and sort of talk more generally about science fiction and
sure.
Maybe
I think when we both had a better night's sleep might be a good idea.
Well, I'm up for reading now, but I'm just thinking saving it for a bit later on in the show. You know, it's like sort of the final treat. Hopefully our readers will find this a treat. But, you know, let's talk a little more about sex and science fiction. What are some of the things you've noticed or that's influenced you in thinking about sexuality and gender?
I've been thinking a lot about this, and, you know, I have to say that even though I've been a big fan, I've been reading science fiction for a very long time, and I've pretty much read, like, all of, you know, at least one or two books from pretty much all the leading lights during, like, the Golden Age, which I frankly stopped reading science fiction back in the early 90s because I found it to be kind of, like, I don't know, I just found it to be kind of, like, repetitive and similar. That's not to insult the new writers. They just simply sort of slowed down and stopped from there. But, you know, I have to say that it's like, it's really kind of a spotty history, in many regards, because, you know, if you think of a genre that is about speculation and exploration and, you know, looking at the future would be better about representation, both about sexuality, gender, you know, ethnicity, you know, it would be a little better about that, but unfortunately it hasn't, though. I don't want to discount some of the really groundbreaking work that has been done, you know, sometimes, you know, unexpectedly concerning the time period. I do think it's getting a lot better. There's a whole, you know, surge now of, you know, people of color, indigenous people, all, you know, different cultures are being representative, different, you know, societies are being representative. And of course, you know, gender, and with many trans authors featuring, and there's many characters and many books now being published that have, you know, gender fluid characters or plots that directly deal with that. So it's really an interesting subject, and I wish I was more of an expert on it. I do have to say, though, that I have a weakness for, you know, reading some of these books during the early periods and stumbling across something that was, you know, wonderfully radical for the time.
Right. Thinking of wonderfully radical, the writer Samuel Delaney is somebody I came across early on. I had found a collection of his short stories, a collection called Drift Glass. And I have to say several of the stories have just, once I read them, they stayed with me, like The Star Pit, I and Gamora. And I have, you know, as I do with many of my favorites, gone back and reread them many times, but they've haunted me and made me think in ways that I've just really enjoyed. And, you know, I mean, a lot of people will point to a lot of, I would say, white hippie types of a certain age, you know, will often point to Stranger in a Strange Land as giving them, you know, insights into the possibilities of polyamory, for example. But I have to say, someone like, but Samuel Delaney's work, he also envisioned, you know, kind of poly family groupings in the Star Pit, or I should say polyamory family groupings in the Star Pit. The reason I corrected is that Polynesian people would really prefer us to use polyam as shorthand for that. So please excuse me for that. Yeah, there was a lot of things that he envisioned with regard to gender and human relationships that were just kind of part of the story. He didn't have to emphasize that, you know. It was there, part of the narrative, part of what people were doing and who they were. And yeah, so I mean, just talking about early on people. And I know there's other pioneers. He just is the one that comes to mind for me.
No, it's an interesting subject, I think, also because, you know, it's one thing when you have like a heteronormative, you know, authors who may experiment, but many, you know, of the leading lights, so to speak, of science fiction are, you know, like we mentioned before, Chip Delaney. Chip Delaney, of course, is a person of color. He's also queer. But also other authors like Arthur C. Clarke is gay, or was gay. He passed away. But yeah, it's interesting when you consider that. So it's like, it's almost like to say that during this period, and again, it has changed over time, though there's been a couple of really kind of like black eyes to science fiction fandom. I may touch on that in a second. But the fan base has been a little bit more conservative than the actual authors. But there's many famous stories of, like, you know, authors who, you know, have had like their own share of, you know, 70s debauches, you know, yet writing what people would consider to be just kind of like mainstay cleft-jawed hero stories. But I want to give a quick list here. These are just personal favorites, and these are ones that were written a while ago. And that's why I think that particularly they're fun and interesting, is because they kind of show that, you know, when no one else was doing it, these authors were really kind of experimenting with all kinds of different things. You know, and this is kind of a jumbled list a little bit because I want to touch on, like, cultural issues, I mean, not issues, but cultural recognition and explorations, as well as gender, as well as ethnicity. One of the top of the bat is Roger Zelazny's Lord of Light, which reinterprets, you know, the Hindu, you know, Parthenon in a science fiction context. And it's just also a beautifully written book. It's really magnificent. I highly recommend that one. It's just, once again, beautiful language. And it's interesting that I've read some criticism that he's appropriation, but also people say that he actually really works very hard to actually recognize and respect the culture. So that's really wonderful. You mentioned Robert Heinlein, and Heinlein, my favorite of his is actually I Will Fear No Evil, which is one that no one talks about and many people don't like, but I love it because it's, here's an author who is unfortunately labeled as conservative, though, you know, it'd be more fair to call him a libertarian, but I'm not going to get into all that thing. And I Will Fear No Evil talks about very much about gender. It's about, you know, someone occupying a female oriented body, and there's all kinds of things. And again, you know, when it was written, it, you know, was pretty radical. Couple of ones here really toss out quickly. I highly recommend When Gravity Fails, and the series that George Alec Effinger did were really wonderful because when they were written, which was I think about the early 80s or so, we have a character who is Muslim who is in love with a trans character, and it's just simply part of the world, not done as some kind of like grandstanding stunt that just exists when they exist. Another one, of course, is really wonderful, is China Mountain Shang by Maureen McHugh, which I remember reading in the early 80s and just being blown away. I mean, 90s, I think, but just blown away by how she handled queer characters, and as well as different cultures and ethnicities. And winding this up a little bit, I have to give a couple of good calls out to Season of the Witch by our mutual friend Jean Marie Stein, which was really wonderful considering when it was written, and talking about a novel where a person is convicted of, I think it's assault and murder, and then their punishment is to be placed into the body of, you know, a different gender. And that's really was wonderful, and it's a fantastic book. And winding this up a little bit, The Female Man by Jonah Russ is a wonderfully, you know, explorative look at women and sexual orientation. One of my all-time favorites, though, is Venus Plus X, and this is one of my personal favorite authors, is Theodore Sturgeon. And Sturgeon is just a magnificent writer, but he also often will touch on sexuality in his stories, and he's written some pretty outrageous ones. A very famous one is called If All Men Are Brothers, Would You Let One Marry Your Sister? But with Venus Plus X, it hypothesizes a pretty much utopic version of a society where, you know, there is a neutral gender, where people are basically intersex. It's a magnificent book, because the whole book is basically about gender and you know, how it's been distorted by Western culture and such. But those are just a few quick examples. There's many others that are really quite excellent. But, you know, again, not to sort of go on too much, I do think that the fandom has shifted for the better, and especially, you know, since maybe like about the, you know, the 80s and so, and becoming much more, you know, tolerant, much more explorative, much more accepting of all kinds of different things. There was a bad incident I do want to touch on, which was back in, I think it was around the 2013, there was this, you know, anti, and this is so infuriating. It's me for getting on my soapbox a second here, because this is like, you know, a genre that, yes, has a couple of really bad blotches on its record. And particularly, I want to call out the homophobia of Jerry Pornell, especially Orson Scott Card. Bob Silverberg, who is one of those writers I totally admire, has espoused anti-trans views. It's really unfortunate.
Oh my
but
God.
This group was a bunch of fans and writers who were literally trying to hijack the Hugo Awards, which is like the Oscars for science fiction, you know, and their whole stance was right-wing anti-diversity. And since then, they've been sort of like, you know, called out, and they've sort of slinked back into the shadows, but it's really kind of a blotch on fandom. But yeah, I mean, it's like, it's really a weird genre when you think about a lot of these things. Oh, I also want to call out a couple of little quickies. When you talk about like, you know, there's so many different levels of, you know, acceptance and so forth. And one of my favorite authors is Ernst Hogan, who wrote some magnificent books. And, you know, Ernest describes himself as Latinx, so it's like he's a Latino writer. And there's also other authors like Ian MacDonald that actually does books that are often set in other cultures rather than Western society. And he's really quite good because he acknowledges the culture and works with it as opposed to making it just a simple backdrop. But, you know, I think there's still a long ways to go, but the genre itself is getting much better with, you know, more open characters, both about their own sexuality, ethnicity, and so forth, but also using the platform of science fiction to, you know, sort of educate and explore that.
Right, right. And speaking of transphobic authors, there is She Who Must Not Be Named. And then, so I'm not going to name her, but I think we all know who we're talking about just now. It's interesting. Somebody that I want to give a mention to is a white cis female writer, Lois McMasters-Bujold, who in the 80s began writing the Miles Vorkosigan series, which has amazing stuff in it. I mean, characters, plots, this is my favorite series ever when it comes to science fiction. But one of her books in the series, Ethan of Athos, it's all gay men on this one planet. And it's a funny culture clash when she, you know, has one of those characters have to journey off planet. But the books themselves contain a lot of, I would say, social commentary embedded. And so there's a lot of clashing of sexual and gender cultures and values that just take place within the context of her book. And so you have characters who are from the planet Beta who are, you know, much more like graduates of the sexual revolution, we might say, you know, pretty loose about what's happening, pretty matter of fact about sexual and gender situations. And then you've got the planet Bariar, which is this, you know, rigid, you know, just coming out of isolation and just entering galactic society, that's very backwards when it comes to gender roles and understandings of sexuality. And I just love how McMasters-Bujold just folds so much of this in and does it so well. You know, some things now, you know, a couple of words, few terms are outdated, but overall, I think that her books are wearing well, judging by what that is. And then I also want to mention, just yesterday when I was bumping around the internet and doing research and, you know, collecting lists of, you know, great Black authors of science fiction and fantasy and whatnot, came across a podcast. There's only one episode that I could find so far, the first one, but the podcast is called Blacktastic, and it's a Black science fiction and fantasy podcast. And I got to listen to this incredible story called An Omnibus Ride in Scarlet by an author whose name I may mispronounce. And if I do, I am so sorry. But it's Balogun Ojeteide, and it's from an anthology called the Rococo Anthology. And it was an amazing story and so much fun to listen to. And I don't want to say anything else about it because I don't want to do spoiler alerts. But I'll tell you, I was just vastly entertained and fascinated. And so I definitely want to read more from this author. And looking at these lists, I can see that there are so many good books out there that as soon as the libraries open, I'm going to be hounding mm-hmm. them for a lot of these books, right?
Absolutely. And that's the thing, is there's so many new authors that are coming up. That's really quite remarkable. I mean, it's like there. I mean, I do like to say that, you know, for a fan base, again, that was relatively conservative for a long time, we're seeing an explosion of, you know, authors and works covering, you know, people of color, indigenous people, you know, different cultures, you know, different sexualities. It's really sort of wonderfully exploding. So I really encourage people to look out and find authors who, you know, especially this kind of new wave, you know, so to speak, who are doing this. I think it's really important to support this with your wallet. I also want to give a couple of quick call-outs for people. I neglected my last list. Of course, we can't talk about, you know, people of color science fiction writers without mentioning Octavia Butler, who is a legend, and rightfully so. She is a genius. Ursula Le Guin, of course, another female author whose work is extremely, extremely wonderful. You know, so I really highly recommend her work. And another one I want to touch on really quickly, just to sort of like give an idea of like what I'm talking about, being this kind of schizophrenic, assuming that's the wrong term, I apologize, this kind of like, you know, kind of like conflicted attitude about science fiction and particularly, you know, gender, is the story of an author who, you know, started to publish, I think it was around the 70s or so, under the name James Tiptree Jr. And this author was really a magnificent author. I cannot recommend, you know, more reading the stories and books. And for a long time, there was a debate about who this person was. And unfortunately, many science fiction writers at the time came out and said, oh, this person's obviously, you know, male-oriented because no one could write like this. Well, the author was actually a woman named Alice Sheldon. And, you know, part of the reason I've heard, and I apologize, this is an apocryphal story, not real, that part of the reason why that she chose a male pseudonym was because of the sexism in science fiction at the time. And unfortunately, the attitudes of the writers kind of like proved her point. So it's really kind of a blotch on, you know, the whole genre because of that. But, you know, look up Alice Sheldon's work on either as her own name or under James Tiptree Jr., magnificent writer. I can highly recommend him.
I am so glad we're doing this show because I'm learning so much and I'm, you know, going to be taking notes of, you know, people to look up and check out, you know, once the libraries are open. I don't think at this point I should be buying too many more books, but that's another story. All of this brings up something very interesting too, which is you have authors who are, let's say, themselves cisgender and maybe heterosexually focused, but who are able to successfully write about characters who are sexually diverse and gender diverse. And then you have the writers mm-hmm. who are themselves in a category. And I'm leaving ethnicity out of this for a second and just focusing on sex and gender, who are writing with these characters as well. And I think there's a slightly touchy issue of representation. And when I started working on the Ornamental Hermits books, my intention was to absolutely, how can I put this, have characters, you know, just like many, 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 I wanted to stack the books with characters who were not cisgender or heterosexual, so that that was actually a minority. And I just really wanted to do that. And by giving the elves, for example, my elves come from a world where there are 29 genders. And to sit down and figure out what makes the elves different genders and what factors are at play was really, really fun. And it was a really interesting exercise for me. And I won't go into all the details because it's too convoluted, but it'll, you know, it's explained in the book. But, you know, I had to try to stay sensitive, and I still do have to try to stay sensitive to where am I overreaching my capacity? And where, you know, what is this fine line that I have to draw, and in conveying the information that a character has certain gender diversity or certain sexual preferences. And mainly, I think it corresponds with what you've described to me as well, maybe I'm going to let you describe that so I don't put, you know, take your words and put them in my mouth. But I think there's a way to do that naturally without straining at it. And I think that I'll say the other issue of being very, very careful about representation came up for me in writing the books, is the first book being set in Hawaii, which of course is a, whether you know it or not, a belligerently occupied kingdom, a land originally belonging and still belonging to indigenous people, the Kanaka Maoli, the native Hawaiians. Being aware of how I'm representing Hawaii and its people and its culture, and not using it as a backdrop, but also not presuming too much. And so it's a really delicate dance. And I don't know if I'm successful or not in how I've tried to handle it. But one way of doing that was to set the book in a not too distant future where the kingdom of Hawaii is actually in the process of being restored, as that its government, it still exists actually according to international law, and I won't get into that, but that its political governance is now being restored and the United States is extricating itself from its occupation there. And so I'm trying to do right by that country and by its people by having that be the future that the novel is set in. So I'm going to toss this over to you, and you can tell me the thing that I was going to say, but it's actually you're saying about how you handle when you're writing about characters whose desires and genders are different and ethnicities are different from your own.
Thank you so much for that, by the way. And I love what you said about your own and respecting Hawaiian culture. I think that's kind of the key part of all this is respect. And it's interesting, we don't have a lot of time here, but I'll talk too much into it, but I've written a lot of stuff, you know, that's just a statement, I'm not trying to brag or something, but, you know, a lot of it has been, you know, queer focused. And, you know, part of that is I simply just kind of fell into the opportunity of writing for, you know, gay and lesbian, you know, publishers, but also because they would often ask for my work, and so there you go. But I've always been very honest about my own sexuality, and I've had many, you know, frankly, really quite touching and wonderful experiences where, you know, an editor or a publisher will reach out and say, I know you're not fill in the blank, but we really need an M. Christian story. And I thought that was really very touching. And I've had some really loving and tender relationships with many editors and publishers. I think, I don't know, it's like, I don't want to grandize, but I do think that one of the big ways of being able to do this is focusing not on differences, but similarities. In other words, if you treat your character as something other than yourself, it will come off as being artificial. It'll come off as being frankly, kind of judgmental, because mm-hmm. you're focusing on what separates this person from humanity, not because of the root nature we all share. Like, I like to say that, you know, I've never had, you know, a same-sex sexual experiences, though I definitely love and care, and I have no problem telling my, you know, my male lovers and such I care about them. It's just that, you know, I just don't bond sexually, and I don't have the equipment for, you know, a different gendered experience, and I can only sort of like empathize with what that must be like, you know, and particular things like asexuality or being trans or something similar. But, you know, I do understand, or I try to understand as much as possible, what emotions feel like. Like, you know, in regards to things like sex, it's like, you know, we all fear, you know, have anxiety. We all worry about our body image. We worry about, you know, did we do the dishes or did we brush our teeth? And, you know, how sex can be really kind of like, you know, kind of sad and anxious, but also wonderful, and just kind of focusing on like the commonalities versus the differences. And it's interesting that when I have come across some poorly written, you know, representation in particularly science fiction, they always seem to do that. They focus on identifying the character's sexuality or gender or ethnicity, as opposed to simply that's just who the character is. Which I think is kind of like a level of empathy that, you know, a writer really should bring to the work. But it's definitely a tightrope walk. And, you know, not to sound weird about this, but I've always kind of considered that, you know, when you're a fiction writer, and it's very important to know that's fiction versus, you know, lying about who you are, which is never a good mm-hmm. idea, that writers are liars. It's our job to convince the reader of something. And if we do our job correctly, when someone finishes a work, they should never doubt for a moment that we are writing about something we are either familiar with or we are ourselves. And that's not deception. That's just fiction. That's telling a good story. And if someone can read a work and say, well, I can tell you're not fill in the blank, and it could be ethnicity, it could be gender, it could be sexuality, then the author has failed. And I've read way too many of those where the author is, once again, just, you know, doesn't get it, so to speak.
Interesting. I don't know if I would say all writers are liars, coming from my standpoint, and I'm not arguing with you. I mean, we all have our ways of feeling into, you know, what we think this odd thing is that we're doing, you know, called writing. But I relate magic. All writers for me are witches and magicians, because we're conjuring things up, you know, and whether we're conjuring up a noirish detective novel or fantasy set in another galaxy, or, you know, a tale of housewife desperation set in, you know, modern day Burbank, we're conjuring up something. And mm-hmm. I agree that how we conjure it up depends on making the characters distinct enough so that they stand out as characters and we know something about their lives. And at the same time, the empathy that you're talking about is really important. We, even with our villains, we have to somehow be able to empathize with them in order to bring them to life. And so we're constantly giving birth and breathing life into people that we don't actually know, but all of a sudden they're there and they're with us, and then putting them into the plots and the settings, you know, and then often doing really bad things to them, because that's what makes the book interesting. So it's, you know, so maybe all writers are sadistic. I don't know. But since we're getting towards the end here, do you, we've got like another 10 minutes. Do you want to do a quick read and then I'll do a quick read, or vice versa?
Well, I have a little section here. It's a little too long, I think, to read too quickly, but I'm just going to read like a little bit. This is just me being playful. This is, I'll give you a little context before getting into it. This is from a story called Happy Birthday, and it appears in Hard Drive. And just to give you a frame of reference, it's about this scientist or a researcher who is, you know, basically working in computer theory. And this is, takes place maybe like 25, 50 years in the future. And he's visited by this female-identified person, And, you know, in at first he thinks it's just kind of an unusual situation, maybe like someone who's admired his work or something somewhere. And then this person reveals that it's actually an artificial intelligence who has basically borrowed this person's, consensually borrowed this person's body. And they basically enter into a, you know, relationship or a sexual relationship as kind of like this world of meeting the two different, you know, kind of like worlds of thought. And, you know, and it is, of course, an erotic story, so there's definitely sexual content. But I wanted to sort of like do this little teeny bit, which I had an absolute blast writing, which is sort of like a meta examination of, you know, basically making love to an artificial intelligence. So this is real quick. It's only like one paragraph.
Okay.
And this is, once again, sort of like, you know, a sort of an explanation of that. And apologize, I'm not a great reader of my own work. So if I stumble a little bit, then, you know, I'm sorry. Here we go.
Oh, please don't apologize.
Fireworks.
Okay.
Thank you. Fireworks in a sky of formulae, comets of algorithms, bursts and pinwheels of programs and procedure, a heavenly display of the environment, the world that flickered and flashed into out of existence from one moment to another, a digitally Darwinian cascade of potentials and possibilities, some surviving to sprout and seed and grow, others neatly backed up to possibly come to life again. Showers and sprays of quantum uncertainties, bursts and blooms of probability. Nothing was really singular, nothing really in control. Behind her eyes was an infinitely deep night sky, lit by the brilliant flashes of trial and error. And then, who knew when, it eventually became a universe of infinite informational life that had become capable of looking at itself and in its own way think, I am. And that's just a little piece right there. But, you know,
oh,
I had a lot
God.
Of fun, you know, working on this one.
Oh, I love it. It's beautiful. Thank you for reading that.
Thank you.
That was fantastic.
You.
I was totally into it there. Okay. Well, my snippet, and it really will be a snippet also, maybe slightly longer than yours, but not by too much, is an introduction of one of my elven characters at the very start of chapter one of the first book, The Dire Deeds of the Guild of Ornamental Hermits. And the chapter is called Beyond the Gossamer Veil. And so I'm immediately introducing one of the several elves that end up getting involved with my hermits from Hermitville in Hawaii. And my voice is a little hoarse, so please apologize, you know, I apologize for the sound. So Septimus Sitwell clapped his hands to his head and moaned, by Varda's panties, another migraine. Who in the human world just poured themselves a kundalini cocktail? Fortunately, there was no one to hear him. His blasphemous outburst would have caused his brethren to compose lengthy songs of sorrow, asking forgiveness of Varda, the most blessed lady of the stars. Septimus was alone as usual. If you don't count his weekly swap meet, jam making, wine guzzling, tea drinking, Mortals and Muppets, trademark, tabletop role play, and management of immortal melancholy, trademark classes, the downside of never dying. His fingernails were trimmed and buffed like pale opals. His cheekbones were splendid. His beard was a shadow of sheer dark silk on his almost translucent chin and cheeks. He wore black leather jeans, spike heels, and a sheer black t-shirt, all human-made contraband. Septimus had connections and abilities. The cost was, however, was steep. It took concentration, as well as the correct use of the Book of Moons and the alchemy of time-space, to coax molecules of human artifacts into the realm and then reassemble them correctly. Septimus never forgot the time he summoned a liposuction machine, all the rage that year, please don't ask why, but ended up with a neck whisk. Sure, there are collectors who pay well for flotsam of spontaneous provenance, and Septimus easily found a buyer, but still, such a disappointment. But that's what elves like Septimus do, don't they? Lorien, certified masters of dreams and desires, summon stuff from other realms and hope to Tulkas it comes out right on the other side. There are worse jobs. So that's the end of that first page, really.
Oh, that's
and
wonderful.
People might notice, thank you, people might notice that I'm actually using Tolkien's elven deities in this book. And I'm doing that consciously because I didn't want to use deity figures that are attached to an actual religion or spiritual tradition. And so as a homage to Tolkien, who's also been very influential in my life, I thought I would go ahead and reference his elven deities. So Varda and Tulkas are two of those. So yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed that. It was one of the things that was fun
wonderful.
To read. Yeah, originally I had him summoning a copy of Valerie Solanas' Scum Manifesto, but I think that didn't sit well with the agents that I submitted, you know, the first few pages to. So, you know, Valerie Solanas being the woman who shot Andy Warhol. but whatever, you know, some cultural references I think are maybe too dated at this point to really have a good look. So, anything else we want to add in these final moments of the show?
Well, one thing I want to throw out, I completely forgot when I sent, you know, when we were sharing information on resources for queer and people of color science fiction and science fiction writers, is a wonderful organization. It's been around for quite a while. They even have conventions. It's called the Galactic Network, and it's spelled Galactic Network. And if you type that in, .org, it'll pop up, and they do a convention. Of course, now concerning with the pandemic, they probably won't have one this year. But they also do a award for queer, you know, science fiction works, and it's called the I think it's Spectrum Award, and I'm sure if I got that wrong, someone will yell at me. Anyway, they're really wonderful. I really highly recommend them. And there are, you know, fan organizations for, you know, people's, you know, who are science fiction fans who are, you know, have, you know, gender fluid. There's also ones for people of color, different, you know, ethnicities and such. So if you're interested in science fiction, definitely look them up. And once again, if I want to conclude, I want to say just try and support, you know, this diversity in science fiction, either acknowledging when the older works did it well, or particularly the new authors who are trying to really kind of like give us a future that we can look forward to, one that's inclusive and tolerant and diverse.
Right, absolutely. And when these books get made into movies, may they cast the trans actors in the trans roles, please, etc. You know, so don't, you know, and that ripples out to the other categories, obviously, you know. So let's give more work to those talented people, the performers and actors out there who should also be incorporated into any media that's made, you know, movies or series that it's made of these books, should that happen, you know, and may many of these authors have that kind of luck and good fortune. So once again, Chris, we've had a wonderful show. The time just flies when I'm doing this. There's always so much more to say, but I hope our listeners have enjoyed this. This is probably a topic that we're going to revisit again, I would imagine, because we've just touched on things. We're just skimming past so much. So you know, good morning and have a great weekend to everybody. And we'll see you next week when we're going to be talking about spectrosexuality, which is a favorite topic of mine. So I'm going to pull out my sexologist hat and tell you about some research that I've done into the topic and some historical background and stuff. So have fun and take care, everybody. And we'll see you next week.